Yes, I have some news for you. As you are doubtless aware, one of my supply ships recently left Earth to return to its base. We have just discovered that there was a stowaway on board. 100 pencils braked to a halt. 100 pairs of eyes fixed themselves upon Karellen.
A stowaway, did you say, Mr. Supervisor? Asked Golda. May we ask who he was and how he got aboard?
His name is Jan Rodericks. He is an engineering student from the University of Cape Town. Further details you can no doubt discover for yourselves through your own very efficient channels. Karellen smiled. The supervisor's smile was a curious affair. Most of the effect really resided in the eyes. The inflexible, lipless mouth scarcely moved at all. Was this, Golda wondered, another of the many human customs that Karellen had copied with such skill? For the total effect was, undoubtedly, that of a smile, and the mind readily accepted it as such. As for how he left, continued the supervisor, that is of secondary importance. I can assure you, or any other potential astronauts, that there is no possibility of repeating the exploit.
What will happen to this young man? Persisted Golda. Will he be sent back to Earth?
That is outside my jurisdiction, but I expect he will come back on the next ship. He would find conditions too alien for comfort where he has gone. And this leads me to the main purpose of our meeting today. Karellen paused, and the silence grew even deeper. There has been some complaint among the younger and more romantic elements of your population, because outer space has been closed to you. We had a purpose in doing this. We do not impose bans for the pleasure of it. But have you ever stopped to consider, if you will excuse a slightly unflattering analogy, what a man from your Stone Age would have felt if he suddenly found himself in a modern city?
Surely, protested the Herald Tribune. There is a fundamental difference. We are accustomed to science. On your world, there are doubtless many things which we might not understand, but they wouldn't seem magic to us.
Are you quite sure of that? Said Karellen, so softly that it was hard to hear his words. Only 100 years lies between the age of electricity and the age of steam. But what would a Victorian engineer have made of a television set or an electronic computer? And how long would he have lived if he started to investigate their workings? The gulf between two technologies can easily become so great that it is lethal.
Hello, whispered Reuters to the BBC. We're in luck. He's going to make a major policy statement. I know the symptoms.
And there are other reasons why we have restricted the human race to Earth. Watch. The lights dimmed and vanished. As they faded, a milky opalescence formed in the center of the room. It congealed into a whirlpool of stars, a spiral nebula seen from a point far beyond its outermost sun.
No human eyes have ever seen this sight before, said Karellen's voice from the darkness. You are looking at your own universe, the island galaxy of which your sun is a member, from a distance of 1,000,000 light-years.
There was a long silence. Then Karellen continued, and now his voice held something that was not quite pity, and not precisely scorn.
Your race had shown a notable incapacity for dealing with the problems of its own rather small planet. When we arrived, you were on the point of destroying yourselves with the powers that science had rashly given you. Without our intervention, the Earth today would be a radioactive wilderness. Now, you have a world at peace and a united race. Soon, you will be sufficiently civilized to run your planet without our assistance. Perhaps you could eventually handle the problems of an entire solar system, say 50 moons and planets. But do you really imagine that you could ever cope with this?
The nebula expanded. Now the individual stars were rushing past, appearing and vanishing as swiftly as sparks from a forge. And each of those transient sparks was a sun, with who knew how many circling worlds.
In this galaxy of ours,
murmured Corellin. There are 87,000 million suns. Even that figure gives only a faint idea of the immensity of space. In challenging it, you would be like ants attempting to label and classify all the grains of sand in all the deserts of the world. Your race, in its present stage of evolution, cannot face that stupendous challenge. One of my duties has been to protect you from the powers and forces that lie among the stars, forces beyond anything that you can ever imagine. The image of the galaxy's swirling fire mists faded. Light returned to the sudden silence of the great chamber. Corellin turned to go. The audience was over. At the door, he paused and looked back upon the hushed crowd. It is a bitter thought, but you must face it. The planets you may one day possess. But the stars are not for man. The stars are not for man. Yes, it would annoy them to have the celestial portals slammed in their faces, but they must learn to face the truth, or as much of the truth as could mercifully be given to them. From the lonely heights of the stratosphere, Corellin looked down upon the world and the people that had been given into his reluctant keeping. He thought of all that lay ahead, and what this world would be only a dozen years from now. They would never know how lucky they had been. For a lifetime, mankind had achieved as much happiness as any race can ever know. It had been the golden age. But gold was also the color of sunset, of autumn. And only Corellin's ears could catch the first wailings of the winter storms. And only Corellin knew with what inexorable swiftness the golden age was rushing to its close. Part 3. The Last Generation. Chapter 15.
"Look at this!" exploded George Gregson, hurling the paper across at Jean.
It came to rest, despite her efforts to intercept it, spread listlessly across the breakfast table. Jean patiently scraped away the jam and read the offending passage, doing her best to register disapproval. She was not very good at this, because all too often she agreed with the critics. Usually she kept these heretical opinions to herself, and not merely for the sake of peace and quiet. George was perfectly prepared to accept praise from her, or anyone else, but if she ventured any criticism of his work, she would receive a crushing lecture on her artistic ignorance. She read the review twice, then gave up. It appeared quite favorable, and she said so.
"He seemed to like the performance. What are you grumbling about?"
"This," snarled George, stubbing his finger at the middle of the column.
"Just read it again."
"Particularly restful on the eyes were the delicate pastel greens of the background to the ballet sequence."
"Well?" "They weren't greens. I spent a lot of time getting that exact shade of blue. And what happens? Either some blasted engineer in the control room upsets the color balance, or that idiot of a reviewer's got a cockeyed set."
"Hey, what color did it look on our receiver?"
I can't remember," confessed Jean. "The poppet started squealing about then, and I had to go and find out what was wrong with her."
"Oh," said George, relapsing into a gently simmering quiescence. Jean knew that another eruption could be expected at any moment. When it came, however, it was fairly mild.
"I've invented a new definition for TV," he muttered gloomily. "I've decided it's a device for hindering communication between artist and audience."
"What do you want to do about it?" retorted Jean. "Go back to the live theater?"
"And why not?" asked George. "That's exactly what I have been thinking about. You know that letter I received from the New Athens people? They've written to me again. This time, I'm going to answer."
"Indeed?" said Jean, faintly alarmed. "I think there are a lot of cranks."
"Well, there's only one way to find out. I intend to go and see them in the next 2 weeks. I must say that the literature they put out looks perfectly sane, and they've got some very good men there." If you expect me to start cooking over a wood fire or learning to dress in skins, you'll have...
Oh, don't be silly. Those stories are just nonsense. The colonies got everything that's really needed for civilized life. They don't believe in unnecessary frills, that's all. Anyway, it's a couple of years since I visited the Pacific. It will make a nice trip for us both.
I agree with you there, said Jean. But I don't intend Junior and the Poppet to grow up into a couple of Polynesian savages.
They won't, said George. I can promise you that. He was right, though not in the way he had intended.
As you noticed when you flew in, said the little man on the other side of the veranda, the colony consists of two islands linked by a causeway. This is Athens, the other we've christened Sparta. It's rather wild and rocky, and is a wonderful place for sport or exercise.
His eye flickered momentarily over his visitor's waistline, and George squirmed slightly in the cane chair.
Sparta is an extinct volcano, by the way. At least the geologists say it's extinct.
Ha ha.
But back to Athens. The idea of the colony, as you've gathered, is to build up an independent, stable cultural group with its own artistic traditions. I should point out that a vast amount of research took place before we started this enterprise. It's really a piece of applied social engineering, based on some exceedingly complex mathematics which I wouldn't pretend to understand. All I know is that the mathematical sociologists have computed how large the colony should be, how many types of people it should contain, and, above all, what constitution it should have for long-term stability. We're ruled by a council of 8 directors, representing production, power, social engineering, art, economics, science, sport, and philosophy. There's no permanent chairman or president. The chairs held by each of the directors in rotation for a year at a time. Our present population is just over 50,000, which is a little short of the desired optimum. That's why we keep our eyes open for recruits. And, of course, there is a certain wastage. We're not yet quite self-supporting in some of the more specialized talents. Here on this island, we're trying to save something of humanity's independence, its artistic traditions. We've no hostility towards the overlords. We simply want to be left alone to go our own way. When they destroyed the old nations and the way of life man had known since the beginning of history, they swept away many good things with the bad. The world's now placid, featureless, and culturally dead. Nothing really new has been created since the overlords came. The reason's obvious. There's nothing left to struggle for. And there are too many distractions and entertainments. Do you realize that every day, something like 500 hours of radio and TV pour out over the various channels? If you went without sleep and did nothing else, you could follow less than a 20th of the entertainment that's available at the turn of a switch. No wonder that people are becoming passive sponges, absorbing but never creating. Did you know that the average viewing time per person is now 3 hours a day? Soon people won't be living their own lives anymore. It will be a full-time job keeping up with the various family serials on TV. Here in Athens, entertainment takes its proper place. Moreover, it's live, not canned. In a community this size, it is possible to have almost complete audience participation, with all that that means to the performers and artists. Incidentally, we've got a very fine symphony orchestra, probably among the world's half dozen best. But I don't want you to take my word for all this. What usually happens is that prospective citizens stay here a few days, getting the feel of the place. If they decide they'd like to join us, then we let them take the battery of psychological tests, which are really our main line of defense. About a third of the applicants are rejected, usually for reasons which don't reflect on them and which wouldn't matter outside. Those who pass go home long enough to settle their affairs and then rejoin us. Sometimes they change their minds at this stage, but that's very unusual and almost invariably through personal reasons outside their control. Our tests are practically 100% reliable now. The people they pass are the people who really want to come.
suppose anyone changed their mind later? Asked Jean anxiously.
Then they could leave. There'd be no difficulty. It's happened once or twice.
There was a long silence. Jean looked at George, who was rubbing thoughtfully at the side whiskers currently popular in artistic circles. As long as they weren't burning their boats behind them, she was not unduly worried. The colony looked an interesting place, and certainly wasn't as cranky as she'd feared. And the children would love it. That, in the final analysis, was all that mattered. They moved in 6 weeks later. The single-storied house was small, but quite adequate for a family which had no intention of being greater than four. All the basic labor-saving devices were in evidence. At least, Jean admitted, there was no danger of reverting to the dark ages of domestic drudgery. It was slightly disturbing, however, to discover that there was a kitchen. In a community of this size, one would normally expect to dial Food Central, wait 5 minutes, and then get whatever meal had been selected. Individuality was all very well, but this, Jean feared, might be taking things a little too far. She wondered darkly if she would be expected to make the family's clothes as well as to prepare its meals. But there was no spinning wheel between the automatic dishwasher and the radar range, so it wasn't quite as bad as that. Of course, the rest of the house still looked very bare and raw. They were its first occupants, and it would be some time before all this aseptic newness had been converted into a warm, human home. The children, doubtless, would catalyze the process rather effectively. There was already, though Jean did not know it yet, an unfortunate victim of Jeffrey's expiring in the bath, as a result of that young man's ignorance of the fundamental difference between fresh and salt water. Jean moved to the still uncurtained window and looked across the colony. It was a beautiful place. There was no doubt of that. The house stood on the western slope of the low hill that dominated, because of the absence of any other competition, the island of Athens. 2 kilometers to the north, she could see the causeway, a thin knife edge dividing the water that led to Sparta. That rocky island, with its brooding volcanic cone, was such a contrast to this peaceful spot that it sometimes frightened her. She wondered how the scientists could be so certain that it would never reawaken and overwhelm them all. A wavering figure coming up the slope, keeping carefully to the palm tree's shade in defiance of the rule of the road, attracted her eye. George was returning from his first conference. It was time to stop daydreaming and get busy about the house. A metallic crash announced the arrival of George's bicycle. Jean wondered how long it was going to take them both to learn to ride. This was yet another unexpected aspect of life on the island. Private cars were not permitted, and indeed were unnecessary since the greatest distance one could travel in a straight line was less than 15 kilometers. There were various community-owned service vehicles, trucks, ambulances, and fire engines, all restricted, except in cases of real emergency, to 50 kilometers an hour. As a result, the inhabitants of Athens had plenty of exercise, uncongested streets, and no traffic accidents. George gave his wife a perfunctory peck and collapsed with a sigh of relief into the nearest chair.
"Phew,"
he said, mopping his brow. "Everyone raced past me on the way up the hill, so I suppose people do get used to it. I think I've lost 10 kilograms already."
"What sort of day did you have?" asked Jean dutifully. She hoped George would not be too exhausted to help with the unpacking.
"Very stimulating. Of course, I can't remember half the people I met, but they all seemed very pleasant. And the theater is just as good as I'd hoped. We're starting to work next week on Shaw's Back to Methuselah. I'll be in complete charge of sets and stage design. It'll make a change, not having a dozen people to tell me what I can't do. Yes, I think we're going to like it here."
"Despite the bicycles?"
George summoned up enough energy to grin.
"Yes," he said.
"In a couple of weeks, I won't even notice this little hill of ours." He didn't really believe it, but it was perfectly true. It was another month, however, before Jean ceased to pine for the car and discovered all the things one could do with one's own kitchen.
New Athens was not a natural and spontaneous growth like the city whose name it bore. Everything about the colony was deliberately planned as the result of many years of study by a group of very remarkable men. It had begun as an open conspiracy against the overlords, an implicit challenge to their policy, if not to their power. At first, the colony's sponsors had been more than half certain that Karelin would neatly frustrate them, but the supervisor had done nothing. Absolutely nothing. This was not quite as reassuring as might have been expected. Karelin had plenty of time. He might be preparing a delayed counterstroke. Or he might be so certain of the project's failure that he felt no need to take any action against it. That the colony would fail had been the prediction of most people. Yet even in the past, long before any real knowledge of social dynamics had existed, there had been many communities devoted to special religious or philosophical ends. It was true that their mortality rate had been high, but some had survived, and the foundations of New Athens were as secure as modern science could make them. There were many reasons for choosing an island site. Not the least important were psychological. In an age of universal air transport, the ocean meant nothing as a physical barrier, but it still gave a sense of isolation. Moreover, a limited land area made it impossible for too many people to live in the colony. The maximum population was fixed at 100,000. More than that, and the advantages inherent in a small, compact community would be lost. One of the aims of the founders was that any member of New Athens should know all the citizens who shared his interests, and as many as 1 or 2% of the remainder as well. The man who had been the driving force behind New Athens was a Jew, and, like Moses, he had never lived to enter his promised land, for the colony had been founded 3 years after his death. He had been born in Israel, the last independent nation ever to come into existence, and, therefore, the shortest lived. The end of national sovereignty had been felt here perhaps more bitterly than anywhere else, for it is hard to lose a dream which one has just achieved after centuries of striving. Ben Solomon was no fanatic, but the memories of his childhood must have determined, to no small extent, the philosophy he was to put into practice. He could just remember what the world had been before the advent of the overlords, and had no wish to return to it. Like not a few other intelligent and well-meaning men, he could appreciate all that Karelin had done for the human race while still being unhappy about the supervisor's ultimate plans. Was it possible, he sometimes said to himself, that despite all their enormous intelligence, the overlords did not really understand mankind and were making a terrible mistake from the best of motives? Suppose, in their altruistic passion for justice and order, they had determined to reform the world, but had not realized that they were destroying the soul of man. The decline had barely started, yet the first symptoms of decay were not hard to discover. Solomon was no artist, but he had an acute appreciation of art and knew that his age could not match the achievements of previous centuries in any single field. Perhaps matters would right themselves in due course when the shock of encountering the overlord civilization had worn off, but it might not, and a prudent man would consider taking out an insurance policy. New Athens was that policy. Its establishment had taken 20 years and some billions of pounds decimal, a relatively trivial fraction, therefore, of the world's total wealth. Nothing had happened for the first 15 years. Everything had happened in the last 5. Solomon's task would have been impossible had he not been able to convince a handful of the world's most famous artists that his plan was sound. They had sympathized because it appealed to their egos, not because it was important for the race. But, once convinced, the world had listened to them and given both moral and material support. Behind this spectacular facade of temperamental talent, the real architects of the colony had laid their plans. A society consists of human beings whose behavior as individuals is unpredictable. But if one takes enough of the basic units, then certain laws begin to appear, as was discovered long ago by life insurance companies. No one can tell what individuals will die in a given time, yet the total number of deaths can be predicted with considerable accuracy. There are other, subtler laws, first glimpsed in the early 20th century by mathematicians such as Wiener and Rashevsky. They had argued that such events as economic depressions, the results of armament races, the stability of social groups, political elections, and so on, could be analyzed by the correct mathematical techniques. The great difficulty was the enormous number of variables, many of them hard to define in numerical terms. One could not draw a set of curves and state definitely, when this line is reached, it will mean war. And one could never wholly allow for such utterly unpredictable events as the assassination of a key figure or the effects of some new scientific discovery. Still less such natural catastrophes as earthquakes or floods, which might have a profound effect on large numbers of people and the social groups in which they lived. Yet one could do much, thanks to the knowledge patiently accumulated during the past 100 years. The task would have been impossible without the aid of the giant computing machines that could perform the work of 1,000 human calculators in a matter of seconds. Such aids had been used to the utmost when the colony was planned. Even so, the founders of New Athens could only provide the soil and the climate in which the plant they wished to cherish might, or might not, come to flower. As Solomon himself had remarked, "We can be sure of talent. We can only pray for genius." But it was a reasonable hope that in such a concentrated society some interesting reactions would take place. Few artists thrive in solitude, and nothing is more stimulating than the conflict of minds with similar interests. So far, the conflict had produced worthwhile results in sculpture, music, literary criticism, and filmmaking. It was still too early to see if the group working on historical research would fulfill the hopes of its instigators, who were frankly aiming at restoring mankind's pride in its own achievements. Painting still languished, which supported the view of those who considered that static, two-dimensional forms of art had no further possibilities. It was noticeable, though a satisfactory explanation for this had not yet been produced, that time played an essential part in the colony's most successful artistic achievements. Even its sculpture was seldom immobile. Andrew Carson's intriguing volumes and curves changed slowly as one watched, according to complex patterns that the mind could appreciate, even if it could not fully comprehend them. Indeed, Carson claimed with some truth to have taken the mobiles of a century before to their ultimate conclusion, and thus to have wedded sculpture and ballet. Much of the colony's musical experimenting was, quite consciously, concerned with what might be called time span. What was the briefest note that the mind could grasp, or the longest that it could tolerate without boredom? Could the result be varied by conditioning or by the use of appropriate orchestration? Such problems were discussed endlessly, and the arguments were not purely academic. They had resulted in some extremely interesting compositions. But it was in the art of the cartoon film, with its limitless possibilities, that New Athens had made its most successful experiments. The 100 years since the time of Disney had still left much undone in this most flexible of all mediums. On the purely realistic side, results could be produced indistinguishable from actual photography, much to the contempt of those who were developing the cartoon along abstract lines. The group of artists and scientists that had so far done least was the one that had attracted the greatest interest and the greatest alarm. This was the team working on total identification. The history of the cinema gave the clue to their actions. First, sound, then color, then stereoscopy, then cinerama had made the old moving pictures more and more like reality itself. Where was the end of the story? Surely the final stage would be reached when the audience forgot it was an audience and became part of the action. To achieve this would involve stimulation of all the senses, and perhaps hypnosis as well. But many believed it to be practical. When the goal was attained, there would be an enormous enrichment of human experience. A man could become, for a while at least, any other person, and could take part in any conceivable adventure, real or imaginary. He could even be a plant or an animal if it proved possible to capture and record the sense impressions of other living creatures. And when the program was over, he would have acquired a memory as vivid as any experience in his actual life, indeed indistinguishable from reality itself.